This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. With Election Day approaching, the Hinckley Institute has been hosting a series of forums called Ballot Ready 2018. The forums are intended to inform and prepare individuals as they get ready to cast their vote in just a few short weeks. This year, Utah has three ballot initiatives for voters to decide on. And today, we bring you a forum that takes a closer look at one of those initiatives, Proposition 2, the Medical Marijuana Initiative. During this year's legislative session, lawmakers passed a bill that limits access to medical marijuana to a very small number of people, those with a terminal illness who, at the time a doctor issues a prescription, have less than 6 months to live. One important note before we get started, this forum was recorded a few weeks ago on September 19th, before state leaders and advocates for both sides of Proposition 2 announced that they had agreed on a medical cannabis plan that lawmakers would consider in a November special session whether or not the ballot initiative passes. On the panel, we have two voices speaking on behalf of Proposition 2. One voice, DJ Shantz, campaign director of Utah Patients Coalition, will speak in support of Proposition 2. And the other, James Jardine, with Drug Safe Utah, an attorney at Ray Quinney and Nebaker, speaks today in opposition to the initiative. And moderating today's panel is Laura Jones, producer at local radio station KRCO.
So we're going to start with 5-minute statements, and we have decided that DJ Shantz is going to go first for the Prop 2.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Can everybody hear okay? So thanks, Laura. Thank you, Jim, for being here today. Just to kind of give you guys a little bit of history on Proposition 2 and the Utah Patients Coalition and how we've got here. So in 2016, Senator Mark Madsen put forth a bill, SB 73, which was 95% of what Prop 2 is right now. It went through the Senate, surprisingly, and I was involved with that process and was shocked that we made it through the Senate, this medical cannabis bill. And then my senator friends who I was close with said, "Now, you know, I voted for this because I know it's going to die in House committee and won't even have a floor vote. So just know that going forward." And I kind of scratched my head, like, how does he know that this is going to happen? And sure enough, it went to a House committee, died in House committee, didn't get a floor vote. SB 73 didn't. So I thought, you know what? There's very few states in the country that have been able to enact substantive cannabis reforms through the legislature. And at that point in time, I said, we need to start putting the groundwork together to lay the moorings for a ballot initiative. We were able to raise a little bit of money, put the language together, which is, like I said, 95% SB 73, which passed the Senate, and start the wheels moving to get this to this stage right now. Initially, this started out very ideological for me. You know, what right does the government have of dictating personal medical decisions of people? As I've been involved over the last year and a half in this campaign and literally traveled the state giving presentations to thousands of people and hearing thousands of stories, this has become much more personal, probably like for many of you, whether it's an opioid addiction that cannabis has helped out or an opioid fatality in a family member, whether it's a family member or friend that has epilepsy or a cancer patient, or like Desiree Hennessy, whose son is a quadriplegic and has chronic pain, or Christine Stenquist, who has a brain tumor in Centerville. The list goes on and on. So moving something that was ideological to now that has become much more personal. And I think that's where we move forward from this, is that this is a very personal issue for many of us. Change can happen in a variety of ways. You know, John F. Kennedy said something very poignant that I appreciated when he said, "Those who want to make peaceful change impossible make violent change inevitable." And I think we're at a point where when we've had polling very, very high, you know, upwards of 75 upward percent at some points, there's obviously a strong appetite to give people this option of medical cannabis as a medical treatment. And let me reiterate, I don't advocate any violence on this. Just as far as cycles are concerned, it's important that we realize that there's cycles in history. And when the powers that be make peaceful change impossible, there's cycles that unfortunately occur. So, you know, change is difficult for many organizations and for many people. If you look at the women's rights movement, if you look at slavery and racial equality, LGBTQ issues, Change is never easy for most organizations and people, but I think we here in Utah are ready. If you would have asked me 15 years ago where I would have been on this issue, I probably would have been with Mr. Jardine and the rest of the opposition. But as many of us have come to realize, and 30 other medical cannabis states have realized, this isn't the end of the world. In fact, it's the right thing to do, and it's the humane thing to do to give patients this option to use medical cannabis for their treatments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shands. Jim Jardine.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here. I represent Drug Safe Utah, which is a coalition of the Utah Medical Association, the Utah Hospital Association, the Utah PTA, the Utah Sheriff's Association, the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce, and many others. And we're here to say that Prop 2, which is a 28-page bill that I bet none of you have read, or very few of you have read, contains a lot of flaws, and it goes way too far. Our coalition included in our statement of opposition that we support scientifically based, well-controlled approaches to medical marijuana, and we include in our coalition patients who were part of the original group that started the initiative but now think it goes too far. And I will tell you, I'll try to give you the four or five reasons that I think this bill is wrong and that our solution, which is to work with doctors, hospitals, legislators, and patient groups to get the right outcome, is the better way. The first problem is that this is mislabeled. It's not really medical in any sense of the word. It has a list of illnesses for which there's very little science supporting the benefits and very few studies that associate with the risk. So a doctor who typically prescribes medicinal forms of drugs to help with some condition, just in this case, according to the initiative, gives a recommend. You then get a medical marijuana card and get 6 months worth of whatever you want to buy in a pot shop. I mean, whole plant marijuana, there's nothing medicinal about it. There's no limitations on having, and the definition of doctors includes physicians, podiatrists, dentists, optometrists, physician's assistants. So one of the listed, among the listed illnesses are PTSD, cancer, or chronic pain. You could go to a podiatrist who's not trained in any of the other epilepsy or other things, and they could give you a recommend card. So the controls are very limited. Once you get that, you don't go into a pharmacy or a state-run store to buy a form of medicine. You go into what looks just like a pot shop in Colorado or California, and you can buy anything there. And I think the best way to illustrate this is that I have a dear friend I talked to a couple weeks ago who has a son with severe seizure disorder. And he said people have said to him, we support you, the Prop 2, because of you. He said, don't support it because of me. I couldn't go there. I can't know from one day to the next if I'm buying the same dosage, the same intensity from these products. There's no doctor that I can follow up with. It won't help me. The second problem is that it makes the standards are so loose that people can who want to misuse it or buy recreational marijuana under the guise of medical marijuana can easily do it. And we know from California and Colorado, who passed originally medical marijuana laws, that that will happen. And this has lots of ways in which this, and I'll just give you a couple. It has a provision that says immediately upon its enactment, if you're stopped for possession of marijuana, you have an affirmative defense that you would qualify for it medically. And as a lawyer, that means you could be arrested, but if you go to court, that's a pretty great thing to have. And the Utah Sheriff's Association testified a couple of weeks ago that that will make it functionally impossible to know if someone has marijuana, whether it's medical or recreational. So law enforcement is going to struggle with it, and we just know that this is going to increase recreational marijuana. The third reason, frankly, that I oppose this personally is that I've invested most of my adult life in trying to enhance educational opportunities for young people in this state. I don't know if you saw the study. We have the highest economic mobility of any state in the union. And I think we make lots of opportunities for our young people. But the studies are dead clear on this, that adolescent use of marijuana lowers IQ up to 8 points. It has adverse educational effects. It increases addiction and suicide rates. And I just think it's crazy to enact something that we all know from other states that have done it will increase adolescent use of marijuana. The fourth reason this is a bad bill is that it precludes local communities from zoning where these pot shops can go. As long as they're 300 feet from a residence or 600 feet from a school or park, they can put it in your neighborhood, and you as a local homeowner have nothing to say about that. Let me just see. I've got one more point, I think. There's two other points. One, the initiative provides there are no taxes on the sale of medical marijuana, so taxpayers are going to be footing the bill for the regulation of this. And lastly, one of the reasons the Salt Lake Chamber is against it is because it's going to really impact the ability of businesses to do drug testing. If you say you qualify for a medical marijuana card, then there's real implications about whether you could be drug tested for it. So there are other reasons, but that's close to 5 minutes.
Thanks. Let's do a two-minute rebuttal for each. Go ahead, DJ.
Can I have the notes of the different issues that you had? What were the notes to go through? I can go one by one on it.
Okay. There's more notes, but you're welcome to my notes.
Okay, let's see. Okay, so it's not medical in any scientific sense. So if you all go to PubMed is where doctors, where different physicians and study groups go and they publish their findings. There's over 4,000 studies done on the effectiveness of cannabis with different conditions. Elasticity, pain, nausea, you name it. There's all kinds of studies done on cannabis, not just anecdotal. In fact, the National Institute of Health has been funding Israel for the last 50 years to do extensive studies on cannabis in Israel because here in the United States, it's near impossible to do. As a matter of fact, the legislature gave USTAR, which is connected to the University of Utah, the Scientific Technology something or other, a $500,000 grant to study cannabis last year. Guess what happened? Did they study it? They couldn't get the permits necessary to even do the study. The money was allocated from the legislature. The legislature wanted to show they're doing something. They couldn't even get the permits to do it. So we are very hamstrung in what we can do as a state, what studies can be done here domestically, but there's been thousands of studies done internationally. And most importantly, the studies are done for safety reasons more than anything, correct? I mean, FDA approval is done for safety reasons. And I think everyone can agree the safety profile of cannabis is considerably more safe than any other drug this individual will be using otherwise. So how can we not move forward with a drug that literally has over 2,000 years of testing or of use with human populations throughout the world under the guise of it's not medicine? I think actually what would be probably less studied would be what has been used as medicine the last probably 20 years versus the last 2,500 or so. Secondly, Prop 2 is too loose with controls, it'll increase recreational use of marijuana. There's been an extensive study done the last by Columbia University that shows that, does anyone have any idea when teen marijuana use peaked? If you listen to NPR today, you'd know. Huh? No, what date? What, like, year? 1998, teen marijuana use peaked. And where we're at today, it's had actually a drop of over 30% teen marijuana use. There's over 30 states now with medical marijuana programs, and there's 8 with recreational. This idea that all of a sudden teen use just spikes is just absurd, and it doesn't follow any statistics or any type of studies that have been done. Harmed adolescents, you know, the real harmed adolescents is when an adolescent has epilepsy or cancer and can't get access to the medicines they need. So that's what so think about the children we are, the sick ones. As far as zoning and local control is concerned, we have put that into consideration where what's happened historically is that counties or cities, as a way of making implementation difficult or impossible, would zone out anything to do with a cannabis-based business. We wanted to avoid that. When the public weighs in on this issue, they've said, we agree with having a medical cannabis program. So would it be right then if Utah County said, you know what, we're going to zone out where there's no dispensaries allowed in our county? We have a society have said that that's not the case anymore. Now, we have certain regulations. You have to be 600 feet away from a school and 300 feet away from any residential neighborhood. And it's the exact same regulations that we have for smoke shops and liquor stores. And, you know, we're open to, you know, even furthering those distances if need be. But what we're not open to is for a county to say, just because this is a medical cannabis business, you can't be in our county. We're not open to that. Utah taxpayers are footing the bill because it's a medicine, so it's not taxed. just like all medicine in Utah, is not taxed. So there are fees. There's fees for the business licenses. This is a revenue neutral program, meaning the taxpayers aren't paying a dime into it or out of it. It's not generating funds for schools on the backs of sick patients. But likewise, it's not we're not gouging the taxpayer to fund sick patients either. It's just revenue neutral, meaning that the fees, et cetera, are covering the costs of the program. And lastly, this idea of affirmative defense. So there's a 19-month period of time. You know, everything when it's spoken of, unfortunately, the opposition has used a lot of scare tactics. But when we have about 5 minutes to explain some of these concepts, most people nod their head and say, oh, that makes sense. It's going to take about 2 years to implement this program. So in November, let's say this passes, we're not going to have marijuana just automatically and instantaneously available for everyone. It's going to take time to set up the licenses and the grows and the dispensaries and distribute those licenses, set up a system to give out cards to medical patients. So we figure there's going to be about a 2-year period of time that it's going to take to implement this. Now, in between, now the voters have said, let's imagine that this passes. The voters have made a very clear and distinct message that these medical patients aren't criminals. So what do we do in that 2-year period of time? Do we continue to throw people in jail that have cancer that are using cannabis? Do we continue to arrest, moms that are trying to get cannabis for their kids with epilepsy? We've said as a society, if this passes, which we have a strong inclination it will, that these people are not criminals. So what we've done is we've given these people what we call, and what they've derogatorily it's called, this free-for-all, an affirmative defense. If you can prove that you otherwise would have been able to access a medical cannabis card under that very strict list of medical conditions, you would be able to use that defense if you were caught by a police officer. The burden of proof would still be on the defendant. You'd have to prove that indeed you would have had access to a medical card if the program was up and running. So the boogeyman that this is a free-for-all, that this is a recreational program, you can go through and see the very strict list of medical conditions that this entails. You know, the idea that to call them pot shops just shows you the angle that the opposition is coming from. These aren't pot shops. These are medical dispensaries that have to go through a dispensary due to federal law. Okay. As much as we'd like it to go through pharmacies and doctor prescribed, that's impossible at this point in time due to federal regulations and laws. So
thank you, Mr. Shands.
Thank
Jim,
you
have an equal amount of time.
Thank you. So the position of our coalition is to follow the science. We're here at the University of Utah. We believe, I'll just say this. I think on climate change, you follow the science. There's no reason not to follow the science. One of the reasons the UMA is opposed to this is there isn't supporting science for the list of illnesses and the approach they want to make. And I would just refer you to a January 2017 summary of all the research done by the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine that found that the evidence was either inconclusive or marginal that this helped the diseases they've listed. So our coalition says wherever the science supports the benefits of medical marijuana and you've identified what the risks are so people know, we're glad to support that. And to just pick up what the Utah legislature's done, it appropriated funds for study exactly for that reason. And even though it was hard to get the cannabis to study, it's here and being studied right now. And our coalition says we'll, whatever that science is, we'll support it. The state legislature, the FDA has studied and approved now 3, what's soon to be 4 cannabis extract drugs. So it has been studied and they've approved those for use. And the state approved CBD oil and is now in process of developing a testing and certification system so people know that what they're buying is pure and appropriate. So there is a way to approach this, but it's science-based, and that's what we support. Number two, I'll just say this to try to move this along. In Colorado, year over year, after medical marijuana was approved, the increase of adolescent usage went up 45%. I mean, that's a fact. And so—
No.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm glad to send the study to the Hinckley Institute if any of you want to look at it. So I'll just say this also. The argument was made about opioid deaths. The deaths from overdose have increased in Colorado since recreational marijuana was passed. So, I mean, we can just look across our borders and see what's happened. So I think that probably, I mean, those are things that I want to respond to, but I won't take all the time.
And you were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. On this program, as you might already know, we record and broadcast some engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. And today we are airing a forum held a few weeks ago that takes a closer look at Utah's Proposition 2, the Medical Marijuana Initiative. Again, we should point out that this forum was recorded before state leaders and some medical marijuana advocates announced that they had agreed on a medical cannabis plan that lawmakers would consider in a November special session whether or not the ballot initiative passes. Here again is moderator Laura Jones.
Let's go to questions. Anybody got one right off the bat? Gentleman in the hat. Tell us if you're a student, too, or why you're here.
All right. My name is Preston. I'm a student here at the U. I'm a senior in cognitive neuropsych research. I'm also LDS, and I'm also a medical marijuana patient from California for the last 10 years. But being in Utah, I'm running into a real problem with that. So I guess one of my questions, first for science guy, I'm also very interested in the scientific research and going where that leads, but just in my time here at the university, I've read in the New York Times three different articles that were about medical marijuana research. All three of them were completely wrong, and the headline of the article was antithetical to what the actual finding of the study that they cited in their own papers were. Problem with research is that marijuana is currently a Schedule I drug, along with heroin and literally life-threatening drugs. So you can't get the approval through the IRB to do good research on marijuana anywhere in the country right now. And when you do get the approval, you have to use government-supplied marijuana, so which is warehoused. And it's poorly kept. It's bad quality. It's been there for years. And so my question about this seems like an easy cop-out to hide behind, and I've heard it for a lot of years from certain groups in the state, hiding behind the idea that we're going to base our policies on good science and scientific research. But currently, nowhere in this country, and especially not in the state, is it even possible to do good research with good quality medication. So I'd like to know what your ideas are for somehow, because it can't be done on the state level, it has to be done on the federal level to declassify or decriminalize or take it out of Schedule I. So what do you propose to do in the meantime to get good science to base your policy on?
So let me try to answer that in a couple of ways. Number one, I can't speak for everyone in the coalition, but I know that I and the Utah Medical Association support reclassifying marijuana on the federal level to a Schedule II.
Is that new, that position?
It's the AMA, I think, has supported it.
Okay.
Now, I'm a lawyer, not a doctor, so I hesitate to say, but I've been told
that. I'm a doctor's
that.
Daughter. I'll take care of that for
All
you.
All right, thank okay. you. Number two, I think the challenge to doing good science doesn't mean you don't do the science. You do the best you can. The study I referenced from the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine did what I think DJ referred to. They've looked at studies in Australia and Israel and other places. They've collected that, which arguably helps. The study being done by the U is using the best marijuana they can do, and the legislature said, tell us what its benefits and risks are. Now, I can't argue that's a perfect process, and I'm certainly not a scientist to be able to speak to it more detailed than that. I just know that as an underlying principle of our group, where it's demonstrated that it is helpful, there are benefits and not overarching risks, so that people can be adequately advised. And if you can get it, I mean, one of our big problems with the proposition is it doesn't come in medicinal forms like pills, where you control dosage and quality. And so I think that, you know, but you said you're LDS. I mean, the LDS Church has made a statement that they support medical marijuana. I mean, that they're not opposed to it in all forms. And I think that's where our whole coalition is. If I don't know if that's helpful, but it's my best shot at answering it.
DJ, you have any comments on this?
How many people have died from marijuana? Do you know?
In traffic accidents, I will just say in Colorado, since recreational marijuana, 1 in 5 deaths is attributable to marijuana-related, whereas before it was 1 in 10.
DJ, do you have any thoughts on the science?
Well, let me just say there's a couple difficult things with marijuana. So unlike alcohol, which is through your system within a couple hours, marijuana stays, it connects to your fat cells. And so they have what you call metabolites. Mm-hmm. And these marijuana metabolites are actually in your system for up to 45 days sometimes. And so if there is a traffic accident, for example, and your blood is drawn and you can show metabolites from 45 days ago that show like, oh, you know what? This guy has marijuana in their system. Of course, these numbers are going to be much higher because marijuana is in the system of a lot of people over there that are using it medically and for other reasons. It doesn't necessarily mean that the traffic accident was caused because of marijuana or they're impaired. It just means within that last 45 days, they had used cannabis. So it's a tricky proposal, number one, with this idea of metabolites. And number two, the idea of continuing to compare Colorado, which is a recreational state, with Utah's medical program, which is considered by the Americans for Safe Access as the most regulated and conservative medical program in the country, I think you're comparing not only apples and oranges, but it's just complete hysteria. The comparables aren't equal. You have to have a very strict list of medical conditions to even access what he's calling pot shops, what I prefer to call dispensaries. And if you have a chance, Jim, I'd take you to one of these dispensaries one of these days, and you can see that they actually look like an Apple store.
Very high tech, huh?
Very high tech.
So is this a generational issue from Reefer Madness to Dazed and Confused? I mean, the Pew Research Center shows that more than 2/3 of millennials back legalizing marijuana, again, legalizing fully, while support is lower among older groups. Is this an issue of...
Well, I can tell you anecdotally, when I was doing tours throughout the state, doing presentations as we had to get on the ballot, I went to St. George, and Alex, where's Alex? He's outside. Alex was with me, and I turned to him, and we had an audience probably as big as we'd have right here for this public hearing. And I said, and it was all full of people that were senior citizens. Mm-hmm. And I turned to Alex, I said, tonight's going to be a really tough night. Because, you know, we get a lot of, it was all about people coming and giving input about the proposition too. And I'm like, ooh, tonight's going to be a bad one. Come to find out, every single person that got up, we had four, you can go online and listen on the Lieutenant Governor's website on the public hearings that we did. Every single person that got up was a senior citizen and supported medical cannabis. And I was shocked. And afterwards, I went and talked to one of these women. I said, I'm aghast. I don't understand what's going on here. She says, you need to go down to Mesquite tomorrow and look in the parking lot. There'll be nothing but Utah license plates, an hour wait coming out the door, and you won't see a single person under 65 years old.
Interesting.
And I was shocked at this analysis. So, you know, if you look at the medical conditions that most that are on there, senior citizens are going to suffer from these more at a higher proportion than any other. I mean, think of arthritis, chronic pain, cancer. I mean, these are going to be much more statistically affect senior citizens than they would mm-hmm. younger people. And as word gets out among senior citizens, we're confident that they're going to use cannabis mm-hmm. as an alternative to the, you know, much more dangerous mm-hmm. And potentially addictive opiates and things that they're already using.
Jim, what is your thought?
So I don't know how any of you watched the Today Show this morning on the report by Harry Smith. He had a report on use of marijuana by older people, which by definition would include me. I should drop a footnote that while I've been speaking about this, I've deleted the Grateful Dead from my playlist.
Okay. But anyway, no evidence, right?
But he made the point that he made a couple of points about the problems with the fact that we're seeing increased use in older people, one of which was when they were consuming cannabis when they were young, it was 2 or 3% THC, which is a psychoactive ingredient in marijuana. And they said that in Colorado right now, if you buy it off the shelf, it can be 20 or 30% THC, which is one of the real concerns when you go into one of these, and it is a pot shop, whether it's clean or not. You can buy gummies, edibles, whatever they sell in a pot shop in Colorado will be available in a pot shop here. You don't know what the intensity is, and it's a real, there are risks associated with that. So there's a hand here who wants to contradict me, apparently.
If you go to Mesquite right now, you can go into any shop, one of the shops in Mesquite, and every package of marijuana has a list on it, and it'll give you the percentage of THC and CBD content. It'll give you the cannabinols. It'll give you the different terpenes, and it'll also it'll give you the whole list of what's in it.
I agree that the FDA just sent a letter this week to one of the producers of saying that the labeling was misleading. So I can't.
There's no standardization is what you're saying.
Maybe it's accurate. I don't know that.
As a commercially, that's a more marketable, that's something that I think you're going to see, especially if it's legalized here in Utah. That's going to be a more labeling appropriate and accurate labeling is something that's going to be commercially driving, and you'll see it more prevalent and more accurate because it's more viable business as a business.
Yeah, and my response to that is I think the state's trying to do that with CBD oil, which essentially has no THC.
Correct.
And our view is the best way to do that is have it in medicinal forms, which is the best way to control what people know they're getting.
And again, just to remind folks, nobody up here is a scientist. You have more information, obviously. A question behind you, Miranda, right there.
Hi.
Are you a student?
No, I actually work on campus as a research associate in psychology. I graduated 2 years ago. So a lot of the opposition to this bill that I've heard is that even though the coalition and the LDS Church don't oppose medical marijuana, they don't like the way that this is being implemented. So my question is, legislative bills get revised, amended all the time, every year. So why not direct that effort to revising the bill or amending it in the next legislative session? And obviously this is an important issue, and if you support getting those medical marijuana opportunities to people who need it, why not direct the effort to the legislative session and implementing that differently then?
The answer is our initial statement said that we supported a legislative solution working. We've talked to the governor, we've been talking. If you look at our initial coalition statement, which encouraged a solution immediately that we thought balanced all these issues, this we think goes too far. We had a majority of the senators and representatives sign on to our coalition so that they were committed.
Right, so why stop the ballot initiative in the first place?
We think it just goes too far for all the reasons I've said, but that doesn't mean we don't think there's a role for scientifically proven, appropriately distributed protections against misuse with medical marijuana.
But won't legislators have the opportunity to amend it once it gets passed? That's how all bills work.
So I've worked on 6 initiatives and referendums in my life as a volunteer. And the whole idea of this is it will be very difficult. And believe me, the proponents will be arguing that the will of the people precludes it. Now, can they do it? Yes, but it's, in our opinion, a better way to do it is to defeat Prop 2 and then have patient groups, the Utah Medical Association, all the people with real interest in this who have all committed that they'll work on a better solution as you go forward. And I'm sure that, for example, we favor medicinal forms, not whole plant, and we favor controlled state-run dispensaries like you have in Arkansas or Louisiana rather than commercial pot shops as an example of where we would think is a better way to go.
Let's right. work our way over here for some more questions.
Sorry, can I just ask a follow-up
one
real quick?
Follow-up?
So if you think that it's going to be revised anyway, like I think the fear is that a lot of people think that if the initiative doesn't get passed, because the LDS Church and the coalition came out against it, then no effort will be made. And since it can be revised anyway, why not pass it and then amend it?
I think the answer is it's better not to start with a bad bill and try to fix it. And if you look at our statement, we have the Salt Lake Chamber, all the signers committed to a solution. It wasn't just opposition. And so, you know, I mean, you can be cynical about that but we thought we did everything we could to get the group committed that would make that happen.
DJ.
So this coalition of, I call it the coalition of prohibition, but you know, I'm reminded back in 2002 when President Bush put together the Coalition of the Willing to go into Iraq. I don't know if you guys remember this, but literally, I mean, you had like Ecuador and Colombia lining up because they wanted to make sure they had their foreign aid coming through. So let's not be fooled by what this coalition is and what who's represented by the coalition and the primary players are. It's much like this Coalition of the Willing of Ecuador wanting to go into Iraq. So just kind of take that into consideration. But I do have a point I want to make on this. When we're talking about people that want to craft legislation, just listen to the words they're saying. These are the same people that the Utah Medical Association says there's no such thing as medical marijuana. That's from Michelle McComber's lips. That's their position. There's no such thing as medical marijuana. Pot shops. LDS Church, we want this dispensed through a pharmacy and prescribed by a doctor. Just so happens to be impossible to do. This is the coalition that now wants to craft a substantive marijuana policy. Now, do you trust this coalition to come up with a substantive marijuana policy to give patients access? Excuse me if I have some misgivings and am a little bit hesitant to throw all my weight behind you guys to say, yeah, we trust you guys. Because if history is any predictor of the future, I think our future is going to be bleak if we give them the ball to run with medical cannabis.
That's DJ Shantz, campaign director of Utah Patients Coalition. And you're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. In this final segment, the panel takes further questions from the audience.
Hi, thank you. I have a question for the gentleman who is opposed to the proposition. You made a claim at the sort of last, before we entered the question period, about the rise in deaths from opioids in Colorado. And it seemed as if you're making the claim that there is some sort of connection between the legalization of marijuana for medicinal purposes and perhaps recreational and the rise in deaths from opioids. And so I wondered if you have a source or a study that illustrates a correlation between those two things.
I was actually making a different point. My point was the argument is made that if you pass recreational marijuana, that will get people from using opioids and solve the opioid crisis. And my only point was to say the evidence is to the contrary, and I'm glad to send the study, that data, to the Hinckley Institute. I don't have it in front of me.
Okay.
In relation to that, however, we're talking a lot about the Utah Medical Association, the American Medical Association. Their journal is called the Journal of American Association, and it's called JAMA. The Journal of American Medical Association. They did a study in 2012 that showed there's a 25% drop in opiate overdoses where medical marijuana is implemented. So that's not in some far-fetched journal. That's in the Journal of American Association in 2012. You can Google that at any time. In fact, we can I've heard it said that more lies have been told on Excel than in Microsoft Word, and so I'm sticking with my guns on that one.
Let's get to another question. Miranda, where are you with the microphone in the back there? Tell us if you're a student too.
Hi, I am staff here at the U. An alum, but I really appreciate hearing more. Personally, I am in favor of medical marijuana, but wanted to know more specifically about Prop 2. And since that's what I'm voting on, I really appreciate what you've already shared. I wondered if you could talk more about the bill that went through the Senate and was passed, and what are the 5% difference between that bill and this proposition, and then what the issues were in the House that caused it to die.
So some of the wonky things would be like number of dispensaries. Some of the rules that we put in, for example, we put in some capital requirements that need to be met in order to get a license. You can't be a felon to get a dispensary license or a grow facility. So just kind of some wonky things along implementation lines. The general feel and framework of the bill is largely the same. As far as why did it die in the House committee, I can't speak for how legislators or what they're thinking, but I just knew that my inclination and how I was interpreting things was that this was a foregone conclusion that this is not going to pass. And that's thus the route why we took to moving forward with the ballot initiative. So,
and I can't speak to it because I was doing other things when that bill was going on. I will go back to this point about who you trust or don't trust. The governor is on record of saying that he'll work with legislators, patient groups, and the UMA to craft a solution. So you can be cynical or not. I mean, it's just, we live in that kind of world. But we've done everything we can to put in writing our commitment to address what we think is the right approach.
The governor's also said he says let the initiative go forward. He hasn't signed on to the coalition.
He has not signed our coalition, but he's come out publicly against Prop 2 as going too far.
But in terms of the initiative moving forward to the ballot and the public having a right to decide, he's comfortable with that. And as the governor, I think that says quite a bit. What would you say?
I would say once you have an initiative on the ballot, there's nothing you can do but let it go forward. I mean,
well, that's not the case, Jim, and you know that because your group is suing us to take us off the ballot. In fact,
it's not my group.
And your group, and this is the same group that called medical marijuana patients repugnant and against their religious beliefs. And so, once again, they want to be handed the ball. I mean, they're all over the board on what there is. Sometimes they support it. Sometimes they say there's no such thing as medical marijuana. They call medical marijuana patients repugnant, pot shops. I mean, this is the group that wants the ball to craft medical marijuana legislation. I'm extremely cynical, and I think not only is it poor taste to continue to pretend like we want this. No, you don't want this on the ballot. This is the third lawsuit you guys have done to sue us to take us off the ballot. So excuse me if I'm not going to go along with these crocodile tears of compassion for these medical patients. I don't fall for it, and there's too much history going into this to know better.
So I'll just say this. I'm a lawyer. Drug Safe Utah is not on any of the two lawsuits. They were filed by an individual.
That's absolutely bogus. If you look at the context of the lawsuits, if we want to pull them up right now, Walter Plum and Drug Safe Utah filed the lawsuits, and there's no way you can weasel out of it. I mean, they're so bad that even you're trying to get off of them.
No.
That's what's crazy.
No, what I'm saying is Walter Plum, an individual, filed it, and we didn't authorize
it. He amended it as Walter Plum afterwards. That's post facto, to use a legal term. So it was originally filed under Drug Safe Utah, Jim, and you know that.
That's true, and we had him take it off because we didn't authorize it.
All right, let's move on to this question here. Gentleman in the hat. Oh, right there, that's fine.
Hi. So I know that you mentioned regulation, and specifically a lot of people that are opposing the bill are mentioning pharmaceutical regulation, but prescribed opiate use is on the increase. And Utah specifically ranks seventh for the highest drug overuse rate. And adolescents are initially getting exposed to opiates through prescriptions, you know, so like whenever they get their wisdom teeth out, starting as young as like 12 or 13 years old. And so there's a lot of call for this regulation, but since, you know, the opioid crisis is just on an increase, it doesn't seem like the pharmaceutical industry is actually even regulating the drugs. And so how do you propose a better regulation that won't send us into another crisis?
So I would say this. I think we got into trouble on the opioid crisis because we wanted to address pain in a broad way, and a big industry promoted it without appropriate safeguards. And I think we should be clear. Monday night in Denver, the Marijuana Policy Project, the Association of Recreational Marijuana, sponsored a fundraiser to support Prop 2 here. You should have no doubt that this is about the marijuana industry wanting to make money here. So I would say the regulation is it goes back to having first knowing what the benefits and risks are so that a person can be appropriately advised about the benefits and risks. And that, I mean, there's FDA, but I understand that's a strict process. But I think the state's approach, which is to approve CBD oil and then have state testing for purity and certification, and then have the University of Utah do research so you can say the benefits and risks of this, and then you tightly control it. The pot shops, the only requirement is you have someone 21 years of age running it. There's nobody with medical training there. And so we just think you can, you know, can you devise a perfect regulatory system? I don't think so. But can you do a lot better? I think the answer is yes.
Let's go to more questions over here, Miranda.
Okay, my name is Dylan, and I'm just a student here at the U. I'm a sophomore. And
studying.
So I'm studying political science and international relations.
Not just a student.
Yeah. I'm learning a lot about this Proposition 2, and the more I study it, the more I have questions. But I don't know if this, I haven't read all of Proposition 2, but a question that came up while studying a few things of it was, doctors are only allowed to prescribe or give a recommendation to 20% of their clientele.
Yeah.
And so how, as a doctor, can you decide which 20%, because there's probably more than 20% that you could prescribe medicinal marijuana to. How do you, as a doctor, prescribe just 20% of that to?
So a lot of what we've done, so Proposition 2 is largely a compromise. I mean, this is an extremely conservative medical cannabis program. So the reason, if you look at the, let's look at the rationale behind doing that. What are the opponents thinking? Like, we don't want Dr. Feelgood just doing prescriptions who's just like the pot doctor, right? Like, oh, you got a hangnail, or okay, pot, you know, whatever, pot. So we took that into consideration. And we said, you know what, we don't want Dr. Feelgood, we don't want Dr. Pot on the corner. Let's limit the number of prescriptions or recommendations that doctors can do in order to get rid of that, those optics. So there are certain specialties, like, for example, pain management or oncologists that can go over that 20% limit. But for the general practitioner, for the vast majority of the doctors, we put in a 20% limit to avoid the optics, you know, as an olive branch to the opposition, to be honest with you, to say, let's not give the optics that we have these Dr. Feelgood marijuana doctors on every corner.
Is this also not just optics, but to prevent, hopefully, what has happened in other states that have medical cards, that start with medical cards and everybody gets them? So if only 20% of a patient base can be prescribed, that can also forestall that situation.
For sure. That was our thinking. That's what we'd like to see happen.
Jim's response.
I think that's a fair description, but there are issues with it. And I think DJ's right. There are certain groups. So if you're a pain specialist, then there's no limit on how much you could prescribe. And this was to address what's happened in other states where once medical marijuana passed, there were people in white coats out on the street saying, come in and get your medical marijuana card. But let me just ask you, this is a problem from my perspective. How many optometrists are going to be prescribing medical marijuana for any, they can prescribe it for any of the listed illnesses. So if you go to an optometrist and say, I've got cancer,
sure,
they could mm-hmm. give you a referral card. And so the 20% limit, I think, is a fair, I agree with him. It was their effort to try to make this look good. But the breadth of the definition of physicians just, it
now let me answer that. So our breadth of physicians that can recommend mirror exactly who can prescribe opiates. So take that into consideration. Everyone who can prescribe an opiate, we gave license to recommend cannabis. That's it. It was that simple. So.
All right, let's get some more questions in because we're running out of time. Miranda, where are you with the microphone? Woman in the green shirt, let's try. What does that say? Are you registered to vote? Oh, voterized. Thanks for your work.
So I do have a question, though. Mm-hmm. It kind of goes back to the 20%. And I'm not fully versed on the ballot either, uh-huh. but I do recommend reading about it because there's some good information there. But in regards to the 20%, so first question is, does that just relate to actual marijuana for smoking? Or does it relate to creams or oils?
It would be actual cards. So it once you go into a, so first of all, just to clear it up, there's no smoking permitted in the ballot initiative period. This is one of the olive branches we thought we would write into the bill to avoid confrontation. Like, there's no smoking in this bill. You know, so much, I at this point, I almost wish we would have put it in there just to spite these guys. But there's no smoking in the bill whatsoever. So what it is that you get a card and you can go into the dispensary and get, like he says, you can get what product works for you. So that would include for creams. It's not telling you what product you need to get in the dispensary.
Yeah.
It'd just be 20% of your clientele could have a card recommended by you.
Well, I hope that we'll show a little more compassion to your example of somebody does have cancer and they're in pain and in treatment. I hope that they would be given a card.
So once again, the oncologist,
make their life a little bit better.
Sure, there's certain specialties that aren't under those guidelines. Oncology and pain specialists would be two of them.
So I would say that with respect to cancer, and I'm going to get the group wrong, but the American Medical Association's cancer group has opposed medical marijuana because the argument has been that it treats nausea. And the studies so far have been mixed about whether that's true. That's at least one of the studies. Look, I'm going to agree. There are studies all over the place. I think you made that point. But there's study. One of the studies cited, I think, in the National Academy's report that I've said found that for many patients, medical marijuana, as tested, had about the same effect as codeine in terms of relieving pain. So our view is if you have tests, studies that show that nausea is helped, you know, if you've got chemotherapy or something, then great, that's fine. The other thing I would just say on smoking is it does say that it precludes using cannabis that's combustible at 750 degrees, but it has an exception, and for vaping and bonging, I'm told that it's 500 degrees, so that isn't precluded by it.
All right, I'd love a student to ask our last question. Students over here, anybody got a question? Here, this young woman right here in the red shirt and the jacket. And then we'll do closing statements.
Hi, my name is Amy. I'm a student here at the U. I am studying biology, chemistry, psychology, and ethnic studies. I was wondering, let's say that this initiative doesn't get passed this time around. What can students or other community members do? You know, like, we obviously have a lot of people here who, whether for personal reasons or other reasons, you know, care about making sure that people are getting access to things that can help with their pain. So I guess, what can we do to make sure that, like you mentioned, like, this is something that is still being talked about, and then, like, maybe in the future will get passed?
So I would say this. I mean, this is democracy 101. You contact the person in whose legislative district, especially if they signed the coalition, say, I'm going to vote against Prop 2, but I'm going to hold you accountable that you've committed that you're going to get a solution that does everything you've said. And that, I mean, I've spoken to my legislators, and I've made clear to, you know, you can call me and say, now you're going to deliver on what you told us at the Hinckley Institute. I have limited influence, but I'd use whatever I have.
So if this doesn't pass, you're committed to equally working to get something that works?
Yeah, but more importantly, so is the Salt Lake Chamber, which is one of the most influential groups in Utah. So is the Utah Medical Association. So is the Utah Hospital Association. I mean, all these people are committed, and as well as all the legislators who signed our original statement.
DJ?
Let me just say, I find it so interesting, this Coalition of Prohibition again, I find it so interesting they keep rolling this out. We're going to roll out Gail Miller, who owns car dealerships. We're going to roll out Scott Anderson, who runs Zions Bank. These are the stakeholders they roll out to say, this is who we want to come up with, formulate marijuana policy. Let me tell you who we've talked to. We've talked to the Epilepsy Foundation. We've talked to groups like Truce, who's the Truth and Cannabis Education Group.
Together for Reasonable Use
of cannabis
Education.
We've talked to patients. We don't roll out Scott Anderson with Zions Bank and the Chamber of Commerce to develop good marijuana policy, and I think that's where we probably differ very greatly in our approach. We're talking to patients. We're talking to people that know the lay of the land, so we don't say silly, non-legalistic, impossible things like we want this through a pharmacy and prescribed by a doctor. We wouldn't make mistakes like that because we're talking to professionals that understand the lay of the land. And so I guess as we wrap things up here, let me just say that for us, this isn't a scientific issue. This isn't even a medical issue. This is a criminal justice issue. And our main contention, I don't want to tell anyone what type of medicine they're going to use. I'm not advocating even use of medical marijuana. But for me, if there is a patient, if there is an epileptic patient, if there is a cancer patient that decides to use this, they're not criminals in my eyes. And that's what this is all about for me. I'm not telling people what to do or how to do it, but as far as I'm concerned, I'm going to fight tooth and nail that they have the right to do it, which is somehow lost in this idea of medical freedom. It's one thing that kind of gets glossed over. What types of medical freedoms do you have to make choices, individual choices, for yourself? And for me, these people are not criminals. We should be reaching out to help them and do everything we can in the most dire need and medical situations that they're in. And that's our viewpoint more than anything.
That sounded like a closing statement. So, Jim, why don't you just wrap it up?
To go back to your question about how do you make this happen, we asked Gail Miller and Scott Anderson to join because they probably have the most influence of anyone we know with the Utah legislature. And having their weight behind this commitment is a big deal. Number two, we would like people who have medical issues to be advised about what the benefits and risks really are. In fact, there's a big risk of people going out and making medical decisions if they're not fully informed. There was a study, and I'm sorry, I'll have to get it and I'll send it to the Hinckley Institute, that said after 6 months, I think it was 61%, but it may have been 71% of people who've been using medical marijuana products for a specific illness quit because of the side effects. People should know what the risks are of what they're going to take. We think there's a better way and the proposition goes too far. Thank you.
We're wrapping up this forum here. If you'd like to hear the full discussion, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour podcast. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Christian Camargo, your producer and host of this program. Thank you for listening.